Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Liping Chen, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Fiona Moore about her new book, Global Taiwanese, Asian Skilled Labor Migrants in a Changing World. This book was published by University Toronto Press in 2021. In Global Taiwanese, Fiona Moore explores the different ways in which Taiwanese expatriate in London and Toronto, along with professionals living in Taipei, use their shared Taiwanese identities to construct and maintain global and local networks. Based on a three-year-long ethnographic study that incorporates interviews with people from diverse backgrounds, generations, and histories, this book explores what their different experiences tell us about migration, intolerant and hostile regimes. Global Taiwanese considers the implication in leveraging their Taiwanese ethnic identity for both business and personal purposes. As people become increasingly mobile, ethnic identity becomes more important as a means of negotiating transnational encounters. However, at the same time, the opportunities it offers are rooted in local cultural practices, requiring professionals and other migrants to develop complex social strategies that link and cross the global and local levels. With rich ethnographic details, this book contributes to the understanding of the migrant experience and how it varies from location to location, how migration changes in response to wider socioeconomic factors, and finally, of the specific case of Taiwan, and how the distinctive nature of its diaspora emerges through wider discourses of Chineseness and Pan-Asian identity. So this is a brief introduction about the book, and now let's turn to the author. Welcome to the show, Fiona.
Hello, happy to be here.
All right. So before we discuss about the book itself, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your research interests?
Okay, right. Well, I sometimes describe myself as an anthropologist who wandered into a business school about 20 years ago and stayed because they keep feeding her, which is a joke, but it's sort of a facetious way of describing my career. I took anthropology as an undergraduate student and became very interested in it and looked into doing postgraduate work and wound up being lucky enough to get an opportunity to study at University of Oxford. And while I was there, my doctoral research was on German bankers in the city of London. This was the turn of the millennium. And, you know, there was a lot of interest in, you know, looking at groups, elite groups, migrant groups that had never really been looked at before. And so I studied how they use their identities to negotiate transnational social spaces. At the end of it, I found that a lot of anthropologists that study organizations, wind up in business schools. Because despite their hard-nosed quantitative stereotype, business schools do usually need a few qualitative types around to bring perspectives that, you can't get with the numbers. So eventually I wound up at my current institution, Royal Holloway, which is very nice. Though in between, I did a study of the BMW factory in East Oxford, which was a really, really interesting time, and also took part in a multi-anthropologist, sort of simultaneously practical and research-oriented project involving Tesco and its subsidiaries in a number of Asian countries, including Taiwan, I think. So, they're... that's kind of the background and how we got up to the point at which I wrote the book, and which is, I will stop here so we can talk about that later.
So thank you for Fiona sharing with us this amazing journey, or also the connection between anthropology and also business schools, this kind of interdisciplinary background, and also this transnational profile of your research as well. So next question is, so this book, Global Taiwanese, so how do you start this project? Can you tell us a little bit about your inspiration, or maybe some of the anecdotes that motivate you to start this project?
Well, I got interested. I was starting to run out of material. I'd been publishing on BMW for quite a while, but was getting to the point where I think most of the research insights I could get from that I'd written something about them. So, I was looking around for a new project, new fields, and I was initially interested in doing something that followed up my German research, because I'd always said that one of the future directions the project could go in would be to look at a different group of professionals in the City of London, a different ethnic group. Now, initially, I actually started out thinking I would look at mainland Chinese, not Taiwanese, because they were quite a powerful group in British multinational business at the time. But it's always hard to get an introduction as an anthropologist to a community if you don't have a connection to it. And so, I tried for a while, didn't really get many places. And then a Taiwanese colleague said to me, I have a friend who works for Taitra, and maybe you could do something with Taitra, the Taiwanese Trade Association, just for those who don't know it. And so I said, well, sure, And I'm glad that happened, because actually I found that in the first place, I learned that the Taiwanese community is much, such a fascinating community, and one that's been very little studied relative to the mainland Chinese. And often, as I discuss in the book, from a perspective that doesn't necessarily historically, from a perspective that doesn't necessarily respect Taiwanese identity as a distinct nation. And then, so I was interviewing Taiwanese people in London, and the points at which it started to cease to be a direct comparison with my German work were, first of all, that the business landscape was different. The German people I was mostly talking with were mostly people who were working for banks in the City of London. And there was kind of a late floating labor pool of people who were German, or, were fluent enough in German to understand the German system. And they just kind of drifted around between the German banks, but they were always kind of associated with a bank or a company. Whereas the Taiwanese people, I found, as I've indicated, the title shows, you know, these are self-initiated expatriates for the most part, you know, not people who, you know, came to London and then, you know, for one reason or another, stayed in London, whether they intended to or not. And, you know, so there was kind of a different pattern. They weren't just sort of working a labor pool, working for a particular community of organizations. You know, some of them were working that, doing similar, but a lot of them were entrepreneurs or lawyers or doctors or designers. So kind of a different set of migration patterns. And secondly, also round about, you know, as I did work on it, you know, my a few connections kind of came to the fore. My younger sister's best friend from secondary school is a Taiwanese Canadian. And so my sister and she were reading what I was saying, you know, quite interested with a lot of interest, and were saying, you know, you could do a comparison with the Toronto community, because it's you've got an insight into the Taiwanese community there, but you know, it's quite a different situation. And I was thinking, yeah, that would be interesting if I could get the funding. But then, lo and behold, an opportunity to apply for a small amount of funding that would, you know, cover travel and expenses came up. And I said, great, I've got an in on the community. I can stay with family and I can, you know, do some research that's at this point not just professionally interesting to me, but personally interesting. So that's where that came in. And that wound up being fruitful in a lot of ways, because although Toronto is a global city like London, as I detail in my book, it's quite a different sort of a global city. The way it's global is very different to London. And one thing that became very relevant as I did my research, the UK, as I was doing my research, was becoming more and more hostile to migrants. And Canada, quite historically, tends to pride itself on being a friendly environment for migrants. So I said, well, that's an interesting point of comparison. You know, do people's experiences differ, you know, in the ways that you would expect given these policy differences? So that came there. And then the final piece of the puzzle, as it were, came in when, again, through personal connections, I was talking about the project with a Taiwanese colleague and saying that, you know, I would like an opportunity to go and do some work in Taiwan itself so that I could understand the background. But equally, a lot of the research funding available was not really something that would work for me, you know, in terms of, you know, what the time, my timelines and my personal and professional commitments. And he said, let me get back to you on that. And then emailed me about a visiting fellowship scheme at his university, National Chungchi, which would actually work out quite well for me. So I was able to go out to Taipei and conduct some interviews and also understand better where my self-initiated expatriates were coming from. And again, I was really pleased. I didn't expect the opportunity to do a book. I will also say that it was serendipitous. I was expecting that I would write some journal papers and, you know, that would be enough, really, you know. But then, you know, a representative from the University of Toronto Press came to the university and said, you know, we're interested in people pitching research books to us. Have you got an idea? And, well, I did, but I didn't think they'd go for it. I thought, well, you know, they probably won't be interested in this, so I'll just suggest it and see if they say no. And to my surprise, they said, no, absolutely, this is exactly the sort of thing we want. You know, there's a Canadian angle, it's multidisciplinary, it's the sort of thing that could work in a anthropology of complex society sort of courses. So, you know, I said, right, I'll write this as a book. And I did write it as a book. And, you know, here we are.
And now we are talking about your book. Yeah. Thank you, Fiona, for sharing with us about the journey, how this research idea start and then eventually turn into a book form. And then especially you mentioned in London, you see the Taiwanese communities, they have very diverse and different career trajectories and also different migrant migration patterns. And you do also mention the London, Toronto, Taipei, there's three different sites for your research and also for your interviewees, which I believe we will talk more in detail, one city by another. And I guess the next question I want to ask is specifically about Taiwan. You mentioned that your colleagues and also your family friends introduced you to some of the connection to the Taiwanese diaspora communities. And so this, I guess this answer part of the question, why Taiwan? But I want to hear you talk more about what makes Taiwan and especially Taiwanese diaspora a specific and also significant starting point for this project.
Well, as an anthropologist and one who specializes in identity, I'm always fascinated by the complexity of identity, particularly in a global context. And, you know, as soon as I started delving into Taiwanese identity, it became particularly exciting for me because of the complexity that Taiwanese identity, often... What I found when I was looking at management studies and business studies literature on Taiwan was it just kind of treated Taiwan, in an uncomplicated way. It just said, we are looking at a Taiwanese company. This company, Taiwan scores the following ways on the following matrices. End of story. And they weren't looking at the complexities of it because, for instance, Taiwanese identity, one of the things a lot of my interviewees were saying was, is Taiwanese identity Chinese identity? I mean, it's a Chinese identity. Most people said that, to some extent and in some circumstances, they identified as Chinese. But at the same time, they also felt that, this was not the same sort of Chinese as being mainland Chinese, and that, they also felt like, that was only part of the story, that in some ways there was a distinct way of being Taiwanese, a country that's majority ethnically Chinese and yet is also Southeast Asian. It's got a distinctive native population. It's got a very distinct history of colonization, not just by the Chinese, but by Europeans and Japanese. And... Also, because of the recent history of Taiwan, you have this difference that I talk about in my book, because that it's still relevant between the Weishengren and the Bensheng-ren, the people who, the Bensheng-ren, who have historically been a part of families have been living in Taiwan for sometimes up to centuries, and the Weishengren, the people who came over in the late 1940s after the communist victory on the mainland. And that is another thing that could affect business, but that gets overlooked if you're just looking at Taiwanese businesses as a unit, with a bit more knowledge. For instance, I was looking at a paper on, a Taiwanese multinational, and, it so happened this Taiwanese multinational had a lot of Japanese connections. And I was looking at that and thinking, I wonder if the company is more, their ownership is Bensheng-ren rather than Weishengren, because, they tend to have more connections with Japan, or is there something more complicated going on? But you don't get that by looking on the surface. So part of what I was trying to accomplish with the book, just as a researcher finding it fascinating, but also as a contribution to the wider literature, was to explore how a complicated identity like Taiwan's, and the complex way that gets expressed can affect real business activities where you're not necessarily expecting it to.
Yeah, I especially appreciate you talk about how the Taiwanese identity or Taiwanese identities is very complex. There are different layers, different dimensions, especially how they are shaped, as you mentioned, by the very diverse ethnic composition, the history of serial colonization in Taiwan, in addition to the Nationalist Party, but also the Japanese colonization, and also earlier, the European colonizer as well. But also, as well as the current geopolitical situation and also the transnational networks that Taiwanese people is making and also reaching out as well. So with that, the second portion of your book title is about skilled labor migrants. So we would like to know more about why you focus on this specific group. So Taiwanese people go to different places for education, social mobility, so on and so forth. But why particularly skilled labor migrants from Taiwan?
Well, in terms of some of that is dictated by, you know, access. The people that I was able to get connections with in London and even and in Toronto as well were skilled labor migrants. And also, you know, a lot of Taiwanese migration, you know, has been skilled labor migration. You know, it hasn't been people coming to work in factories. It's been, you know, people coming to study overseas, for instance, and then once they had their degree, deciding to stay or to stay for a few years that turns into a long time. So there's a distinct skilled component, I think, to the Taiwanese diaspora. And so I wanted to capture that. There's also, I think, a lot of interest these days in skilled labor migration. In the labor migration literature, this is because a lot of the traditional literature is focused more on unskilled labor migration. And so it's interesting to then kind of widen the net and see how this compares to other sorts of migration, but also because skilled labor migration is, I think, becoming more and more crucial and is going to continue to be so. For instance, one of the ways in which companies in Britain deal with the problem of, you know, the dilemma, you know, the policy environment is hostile to migrants, so they can't, you know, just simply bring people over to London the way they used to, but they need people with certain skills, like, say, Mandarin language skills or familiarity with the Southeast Asian business environment. You know, previous... Or if they're a Taiwanese company, then previously maybe they might have sent an expatriate over and now they can't. So what they look at is they look at people who've made it there under their own steam, you know, people who went to university in London or, you know, who came over working for a company and stayed. And that way, you know, they have, you know, they don't. They have people who have the skills of expatriates without the company needing to go through all the trouble that they used to go to in getting expatriates. You know, these come with their own challenges and issues. But I think, you know, as barriers to migration become more common with the pandemic and with you know, the impact of on the travel industry these days, you know, I think we're just going to see more and more companies relying on people who travel out under their own steam and stay. And so we need to understand what motivates people like that and why they come and why they stay and what companies can do to get the ones they want.
Yeah, and then especially thank you for unpacking this kind of migration policies and also different circumstances that make the skilled labor migrants from Taiwan a specific and also a significant case. What you say reminds me about the situation in United States as well. So in the 70s, A lot of Taiwanese professionals, also migrates to United States, and then they are professionals, doctors, engineers, and students, or specifically graduate students. So here you do see that there's a specific profile of this wave of migrants from Taiwan to United States. And I believe it was here and there called a brain drain from Taiwan. So because all the quote unquote good people, professionals are in United States. And then later on, we see a lot of different discourses about, you know, the success, quote unquote, the success of the Asian American societies, the minority models, so on and so forth. So, what do you say? Let me think about this, if you will, the kind of comparison or this trajectories about how migration policies and also geopolitical circumstances shape Taiwanese diaspora in different contexts as well. So with that, and then to think about the different contexts and different situations, circumstances, in your book, you unpack the global and local networks, these skilled labor migrants from Taiwan. They make and they also facilitate as well. So can you tell us a little bit about what is the network society? And how does the Taiwanese skilled labor migrants help us to understand or maybe complicate this concept of the network society?
Okay, thanks. But before I answer that, I think I'd like to speak a bit to your other point. One of the things that I found really interesting in my research and that I'm really pleased I had the opportunity to study was that there were quite clear differences, similarities too, but differences between different generations and cohorts. I was pleased that I was able to look at different generations of migrants because you saw people who had migrated during the Cold War had very different experiences and very different migration patterns to people who'd migrated afterwards. I talked to a lot of people from who'd migrated in the 90s as the global society opened up. And this was also interesting in the Canadian context because, this brings in another layer that with London, everybody wanted to go to London. Not a lot of people wanted to stay in London, even of the ones who did. But, if you ask people, who'd migrated, to London, say in the 70s, why London? They were like, oh, well, the opportunity to study in London, study at, say, St. Martin's School of Design, that was just an opportunity not to be missed. And you talk to people in Toronto, and what you get was people who said, well, there was this scholarship program in the 70s for Taiwanese people to study in the USA, and I wanted to study in the USA, and I didn't get into any American universities, so I wound up at a Canadian one. people were happy in the end that they came to Toronto. They also didn't start out wanting to go there, that it was kind of a story of I wanted to migrate to the U.S. and, somewhere along the way took a different turn. So I found that all interesting and also interesting in terms of Canadian identities as, the country next door to the U.S. in the north and, locked in a slightly uneasy relationship with it. But in terms of the network society, thanks for asking about that. The network society was a concept that in a way my book has been testing or revisiting. In the 1990s, as people began to study migrants and migration and people constructing lives in global settings, one of the big academic theories or discourses, however you want to call it, that came out was one by a geographer called Manuel Castells, who wrote a book called The Rise of the Network Society. And that was kind of his big theory, that what we were seeing was the construction and the evolution of a society that wasn't existed in networks. It wasn't sort of linked to a single piece of geography or even a couple of pieces of geography, that people were kind of existing in the spaces between places. And anyway, you know, that's all very well in around the turn of the millennium. So, but since then, we've had wars, we've had conflicts, we've had recessions. I mean, we've had a lot of the sort of thing that made everybody say, you know, kind of, is this the end of globalization? And yet globalizing processes still continue, you know. As always, you know, with the pandemic recently, everybody was saying, oh, is this the end of globalization? You know, with the pandemic and then with the logistics failures. But interestingly, and kind of in support of my thesis, the answer so far has been not necessarily. What's instead happening is companies finding different ways to be global and people finding different ways to be global. So as it becomes harder to travel to different places, suddenly everybody discovers video conferencing. And as it becomes harder to you know, people are talking about more and more about onshoring manufacturing. So, you know, returning to a day when manufacturing is done locally. But as some people have noted, back in the 80s, you know, manufacturing may have been done locally, but it was mostly done by migrants. So, you know, even when it looks global, it's it looks domestic, it's actually globally rooted. And I think things are now so deeply globalized that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to disentangle the threads. You know, you could start, you look at an Apple computer today, for instance, and it's, you know, part of it's manufactured in Malaysia and part of it's manufactured in Taiwan, of course, and part of it's designed in California and some of it's made on the mainland. And, you know, you can, you know, maybe start manufacturing all those pieces in one place, but, you know, the design is going to take place somewhere else. A lot of the components are going to be manufactured in other places just because of skills and knowledge reasons. So, you know, my argument is that, you know, so anyway, so part of my aim was to, first of all, actually study a network society in the network. A lot of the studies of network societies up until recently have been studies of, you know, at nodes in the network. So, you know, study the Taiwanese in London and study, understand the Taiwanese diaspora that way. But I'm looking at more than one part of the network, and I'm looking at the home country as well. So I'm looking at different nodes in the network, and from there, the spaces between. And secondly, also, I'm looking at the fact that globalization changes, and yet people continue to do global things. So, you know, so what does that mean? And have we really understood how globalization works?
Right. And so thank you for telling us about the network society and also how your approach this concept with the case of Taiwan diaspora, and especially you study the different nodes of the network that they built and also the spaces in between all these nodes as well. And also, just very briefly, thank you for mentioning the Canadian case that I was just mentioning about this kind of trans-Pacific context of migration in the 70s. And then you kind of make this beautiful connection to what I just came to my mind. And so you kind of bring this kind of Taiwanese diaspora together in a way that this American context, they have Canadian and also United States situations as well. So with that, so now I would like to ask you a little bit more about the background of your interviewees. As you mentioned, they are skilled labor migrants, and then, but you also mentioned you interview different generations and different cohorts. So can you briefly tell us about the backgrounds and maybe also the general profile of your interviewees that you study in this book?
Okay, well, general profile beyond that everybody was skilled, at least, in the sense that everybody had a post-secondary education, everybody was working in generally a skilled trade, and, or as a professional, they all had that aspect in common. However, there were differences in terms of what you were employed in and, what your career paths were. So, for instance, there were a lot of people who, went into engineering and, and other STEM subjects. Talking about the Canadian side of it and the Canadian-American relationship aspect of this, more than one of my Canadian interviewees had careers across the border. They had worked in the U.S. as well as in Canada, or had worked in the U.S. and then started in Canada, gone to the U.S., come back to Canada. So that was quite flexible and, and also, means that you can't just simply say, the Taiwanese in X country, because, they may move from X country to Y country over the course of their career. And, there were other patterns, that were generational and gendered. For instance, a lot of my older women interviewees were in real estate or similar, which, makes sense if you think about the differences in gender patterns that in the 70s cohort, for instance, a lot of men are going to be migrating as doctors, as lawyers, as engineers, and they're going to bring their wife. But their wife is going to also want, after a while, she's going to want to have her own career as well. And real estate is one of the ways in which women often do it, because it's something you can do. You can fit around parenthood relatively easily. It's easy to train for. There is a big housing market. And so, and also I noticed there was a lot of friend referrals, a lot of people who, were looking for a job. And then their friend said, well, I'm a realtor with Royal LePage. I could get you an interview. And so things follow along that way. One of the things I noticed with, my Gen X and millennial informants was that there were, in both genders, there tended to be career shifts, people starting out in something like engineering or biology and then shifting mostly to the tech industries, IT or similar, but also other areas, the teaching and education, things like that. So, after the Cold War, what we tend to see is more career flexibility among both genders, and also kind of more of a flexibility of identity, more people saying, I will make it my children's choice, whether they want to explore their Taiwanese heritage or not. And if they don't, I'm, not going to force it upon them.
All right. So thank you for mentioning this, the generations and also the gender, but also the transnational movement, and also I should say transnational movements. As you point out that these individuals, these professionals, they might be relocating one places and then to another as well. So it's not necessarily just one destination. It could be multiple destinations, multiple nations involved in their careers. So this kind of transnational movements, this different trajectories and also multiple location in their careers. So with that, now we know a little bit more about the interviewees. So earlier you mentioned why you focused on Taiwanese skilled labor in London and Toronto and how you get a connection into these diaspora groups in London and Toronto. So can you tell us about the experience of these skilled labor migrants in the two cities? What do you find is the similarity or maybe the different experiences?
Well, the metaphor I wound up using in my book, and I mean, bear in mind that this is just an observational lens and people's experiences are of migration are always very different. The concept that brought it home to me was the idea of the sojourner society versus the settler society. As I mentioned, with London, you know, kind of everybody wants to go to London, but not everybody wants to live there long term. And, you know, this is true, you know, not just of migrants from outside, but even within Britain, you know, if they've got the it's almost a trope, you know, the idea of people who come to London and then move out in later life. So London is very much kind of a sojourner society. Everything in London is predicated on the idea that you likely won't want to stay, that you'll likely want to move on after a few years. And meanwhile, in Toronto, I argue that's the settler society, because even though people might move on after a few years, everything seems to be kind of predicated on the idea that you're going to want to stay long term. Now, one thing I often cite about this, because again, it was one of these insight moments, was when I was realizing that you get, in both cities, you get adverts for immigration lawyers on the public transport, you know, the tube or the subway. But in London, the services are, you know, ones that will help you get your green card to the USA. And in Toronto, what they're mostly advertising is services that will help you bring your family over from wherever you migrated from. And I was like, that's an interesting difference just in terms of how people are treating migrants, you know, that London is treating it with the approach that you're going to be wanting to go to New York. And Toronto is treating it with the approach that you're going to want to bring your spouse and children. So it doesn't mean that more people stay in Toronto. They don't necessarily. It doesn't mean that more people leave London. They don't necessarily. But it does mean that people are viewing their time in both cities very differently.
Yeah, and then I especially appreciate you mentioned the advertisement differently, how it is different in United States or in Toronto as well. So I think, as you mentioned and also discussed beautifully, this reflects the immigration policy and in some cases the barriers that these individuals face. So in the beginning, for example, in a United States context, it might be their own visa status. So they need to file for themselves first. But in the Toronto, for example, that for them, especially for the skilled labor, they might be getting the visa or work permits, and now they are thinking about next step. That is their families and their spouse. So I think this definitely a great example to reflect the different migration policies, situation, and also the reality that these people face. So with that, in your book, you mentioned that either sojourner or settler, that's the Taiwanese diaspora, individuals in London or Toronto, they are building and then also shaping a network. And this is the transnational network. So can you tell us about how do these Taiwanese skilled labor migrants use their ethnic identity to construct and shape transnational network focused on Chineseness and or Taiwaneseness?
Well, one of the things that really struck me is that because identity is complex and multifaceted, people can use the identity to build connections within the community, as you'd expect, but also outside the community. So, for instance, a lot of London Taiwanese would construct networks with Hong Kongese and Malay Chinese, you know, along the people who had similar experiences of identity, of, you know, of a Chinese identity that's Chinese but not of the mainland. And, you know, those identities are also quite different, but you can see that there's, you know, a use of shared Chineseness and a specific experience of Chineseness to build a connection there. And similarly, in there were times when the Toronto context, when people self-identified as Taiwanese, you know, there was a Taiwan town, and also the, you know, the ways in which it expressed itself. I remember I went to, you know, when I was doing my field work, I went out to the Asia Pacific Mall, which is a big, you know, Pan-Asian shopping center on the outskirts of Toronto. And then, you know, I had my father with me. He was helping with transport, you know, mostly driving me because I was jet lagged. And, you know, and so I said, after we discovered there was another little shopping mall nearby that seemed to be Asian, so I said, let's check that out. And after about 10 seconds in the place, I said, this place is Taiwanese. You know, you wouldn't necessarily know it unless you knew, but, you know, the DVDs on offerings, the food on offer, you know, all of this is saying this is a Taiwanese place. So, you know, it's showing your identity through just kind of subtle things, the food you eat, the products you consume. You know, there was a pastry shop that I used to shop at when I lived in Toronto. And, you know, it wasn't until I did my study that the penny dropped that this was a Taiwanese place. So, you know, it is about using the subtleties of identity and also the connections, you know, the common ground that different identities provide to negotiate these transnational spaces, to make business contacts, to make social contacts, to make contacts that wind up as both. Again, one of the interesting points came, I interviewed some people from the Taiwanese Student Association in Oxford, and, you know, amusingly, the Taiwanese Association in Cambridge wouldn't talk to me because of the famous rivalry between Oxford and Cambridge. There's an identity to having gone to Oxford. You know, the alumni networks keep you up. You know, there are alumni events. The alumni office follows you around the world. And so there was kind of a connection between, you know, a Taiwanese identity and a having gone to Oxford identity that people used. You know, so there were alumni connections that people could leverage, you know, that were a form of identity, which people would sometimes use to build business contacts and sometimes just use for their own non-business ends or social ends. And, you know, and in that way, kind of a thriving business diaspora develops.
Yeah, and then especially you mentioned that the ethnic identities are reflected, as you mentioned, in that shopping mall, the different food items that they have there, and also the different cultural products that they have there. So, and how that actually, you know, shape the community or specific the diaspora community there as well. So we talk about the network society and then also the transnational networks. And in your book, you mentioned that the network organization, they are two forms. One is the formal one and the other is the informal organization. Can you tell us how Taiwanese skilled labor migrants, they participate in these two different kinds of organization, and then what's their experiences look like?
Yeah, well, there's formal, definitely formal migrant associations, things like, you know, there was a Chinese migrant community network, which obviously dealt with the diaspora as well. And, you know, so, you know, to formally help people with kind of basic issues like visas, finding housing, help, things like that. There were Taiwanese business organizations like TITRA or TMAT, the Toronto Taiwanese Merchants Association. But there were also informal ones, you know, networking that went on just through social connections, through parties, through even things like language clubs or alumni associations, you know, which I wouldn't say were formal migrant associations, but which people definitely used as migrants to build connections and you know, develop networks that they could use in more formal contexts. You know, and the opposite was true. You know, I went to a meeting of the European Taiwanese Association, and there was as much socialization going on, as there was business deals being done. But it was obvious that the two were hard to extricate from each other. You know, if somebody is holding a party, then people are going to remember that person, later on, and maybe agree to do business with them. You know, there was a travel agency that everybody in the London Taiwanese community used, because they all knew the lady who ran it and knew that she was Taiwanese and knew people in the community and was very helpful. And then sometime later, when I was in Taipei, I found out that that same travel agency was one that people at National Chungji University also used to arrange European travel. So good heavens, you know, it is a small community and people build connections in complicated ways.
Yeah, and then especially you mentioned and discussed as well, this how this connection and also turn into the business interaction as well. They are making decisions, they are buying tickets, travel plans and everything. So this kind of like the communities in terms of the sense of belonging, but also this kind of like business contact as well. And earlier, we talked about the globalization, and especially you mentioned in COVID, you see there are different ways and models of globalization. So how the world is deeply globalized, even though facing different challenges such as COVID, it's just how globalization is being carried out differently. And in your book, you also mentioned that globalization, and another way to look at it is as a differentiated social activity. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, no, this was kind of the wider theoretical conclusion of my work, you know, above and beyond just looking at a particular diaspora at a moment in time. As I said earlier in this interview, one of the things that I wanted to look at was at globalization, not as a, is it disappearing? But let's look at this as, what's happening to it, you know. And one of the conclusions I came to, so as I said, one thing that seemed evident to me was that globalizing processes were continuing, you know, even though there were new barriers to globalization happening. And also that looking at the different demographics of the people in my study, that globalization had happened even at times that people don't normally associate with globalization, because the people in my research who had migrated in the 50s or 60s or the early 1970s, were migrating before we often see globalization as starting. And yet they clearly had global connections and were engaging in activities that we would consider globalizing. So what I think we need to see is globalization as a differentiated phenomenon, not a unified whole, because one of the things I also noticed was that, as I said earlier in the interview, that there were different ways of being global in London and Toronto. You know, London very much engaged with global finance and, post-colonial structures, where Canada's globalization came mostly from exporting the in the resource extractive activities and through Canada's reputation as a good place for migrants. So different ways of being global, but also, as I said, different demographics, all of them experiencing globalization, but in different ways and at different times. So my argument, my final conclusions of the book are that it's too simple to really just say globalization. You know, in fact, we need to be looking at globalization, you know, differentiated globalization, globalization as a phenomenon that's different in different times and different places. And maybe that'll allow us to have, do research that's able to capture the nuances of a world that's global as much as it is local.
Yeah, and then this kind of different nuances and also the uneven terrain in this process and also situation of globalization, as you mentioned, in the local context, in the transnational context, in the national context as well. And now you finish this book, and then what's your next project, or what are you working on right now?
Well, I have just launched another book, which is a more popular management text called Management Lessons from Game of Thrones. And in that, yes, I know, it started really as a bit of a joke, as a kind of a teaching tool to teach my students human resource management concepts by using Game of Thrones as an example. But, a bit more seriously, it turns out that a fun way for people to learn, people learn best when they're having fun, and a fun way for people to learn is to think about things like how the Night's Watch does human resource management, or how mergers and acquisitions are like medieval weddings and medieval warfare. So that's just out from Edward Elgar Press. The paperback edition is only $30 or £20 or local equivalents. You can get it from Edward Elgar's website or from Amazon or wherever you get your books. But that's also led on to some other research activities, because I'm currently writing some academic papers based on the research I did to do the book, because on a more serious side, for instance, there's a lot of literature about using fiction to teach people learning to be leaders how to be leaders. And the interesting thing about Game of Thrones that way is that it's got many good examples of female leadership, and women really need fictional and historical role models in leadership. So looking at Game of Thrones and looking at the trouble that the female characters face as metaphors for the problems that female leaders face in organizations, useful teaching tool. And then it just kind of expands from there, because I'm talking with colleagues in the United States about doing studies of fantasy fans and how they interact with their, the product, as it were, how they the TV series they or book series that they love, and how they consume it, or how they resist consuming it. So this is kind of a new direction for me, but one that I'm really enjoying as a journey.
Yeah, I mean, they all sounds great, and especially how exciting, like, you can turn Game of Thrones to research material, but also for teaching as well. Definitely, I think this is a very engaging and also exciting material for students. And also, I mean, for us, for the readers, and also our audience as well. So we look forward to reading about your book and also more of your works in the future. Fiona, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoy our conversation.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's been really fun.
And also thank you, our audience, for staying with us till the end. Take good care. We will see you next time.
See you
soon.
Bye-bye.